through 43. And when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered around him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." And he went with him. And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years, and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, "If I touch even his garments, I will be made well." And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see who had done it. And the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. But he put all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. And he strictly charged them that no one should know this, and told them to give her something to eat. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. In 1991, Jerry Sitzer, he was a university professor and author. He was traveling with his family in rural Idaho. They had just visited friends at a Native American reservation, actually, and they were on this lonely and dark bend of road coming out of the reservation, and suddenly another car came around the corner. Toxicology reports later indicated that supremely drunk, and hit them head on. And in the car was his mother, his wife, and his three children. And in just the blink of an eye, his mother, his wife, and one of his children was killed instantly. They died there in his arms, he said, in the book. It's called Grace Disguised. I highly commend it to you. It's one of the most profound meditations on suffering you'll ever read. And he says in the book that everything that he believed about God, everything was on the table. It was on trial. Because when you experience tragedy, when you experience suffering, everything about what you think that you know about God, everything that you think you believe about God is up for grabs. It's there. And so I want to say this to many of you this morning, because the truth is many of you right now are in that place. Now, it may not feel as extreme as what Sitzer experienced, but your suffering, your experiences of trauma are just as real and just as true as anyone else's. And so the question for you is that where you're at? Where you're saying, what do I actually believe about who God is? What do I actually believe about the nature of God? Is God good and is God powerful at the same time? And that's true whether your pain and your suffering this morning is chronic, like that woman, or it's sudden, like Jairus. And so, to you this morning, I want you just to be able to stop and breathe and rest for a second and ask the question, is God good in my suffering? That's where we're going to go. That's what we're going to tackle today. This story is really not just about Jairus. It's not really about this woman. As vivid as their stories are, it's ultimately about Jesus, about the nature of who Jesus is. Is he trustworthy? And I want to suggest that if you come to know him the way that this text tells us that we can know him, you can find the faith to be sustained no matter what it is, come hell or high water this morning. And so here's what we're going to do. We're going to look at it through three prisms or three ways. First, we need to look at the life that we endure. Let's be realists this morning about the true nature of suffering. And then second, we're going to talk about the touch of Jesus, the touch that he gives. Then finally, the hope that we can have. The life we endure, the touch he gives, and the hope that we can have. That's the trajectory as we look at this passage. Let's jump in here with the first thing, the life that we endure. Jairus and this woman, she's not named, they could not be more different from each other. Jairus is a synagogue ruler, which meant that he was a person of prominence, probably even financial prominence as well. He's a person of influence. This man is a morally righteous and upstanding citizen of the community. And this woman could not be more different, right? She doesn't even have a name in the text. She's a social outcast. She's impoverished, we find out from the text. She spent everything she has on these physicians. And so this woman, and by the way, because she was unclean, because of this disease that she had, she can never enter the temple. So she's a true social outcast, if ever there was one. And yet, though they are so different on the outside, they're so similar on the inside. Why? Because they're desperate. They both come to Jesus looking for the same thing. They're both coming looking for a cure, don't they? And so I want us to see, though they look so different on the outside, what unites them is suffering. And so I want to begin here with, just in general, before we really jump into these two stories, I want to begin here with you, especially if this is your story right now, if suffering is something that's very present for you right now, I want you to hear this. You don't know how much you need Jesus until Jesus is all you have. And that's what it means. Like, that's what we ultimately believe as Christians, is that once you put away all the accoutrements of life, once you put away all the finery of life, right, you don't know how much you need Jesus until Jesus is all you have, right? And then there's a second thing that really follows from that, and that is this, that suffering strips you of self-determination. Let me say that again. Suffering strips you of any sense that I'm captain of my own destiny. This morning, you can have a tremendous career. You can be killing it in the marketplace. You can have a wonderful marriage. You could be enjoying life here in the city. You could have all the finery, all the things that Western capitalist, Western America, Western culture tells us is this is what makes for the good life. And you know this, just like that, when suffering comes, or if it's chronic over a period of time, you know this, don't you? You know this with me, that suffering changes all that. It has a tendency to put things in perspective as to how we should be thinking about life. That's what suffering does. And so suffering kills self-determination. So in general, what do we want to see? We see this man and we see this woman. They're both are desperate. And one has prominence. One has a determined life, self-determined life, and it's gone. The other one doesn't have really that. But suffering is put in perspective all the same here. And so it raises questions. If you're here this morning and you chronic or sudden, and if you've not asked these questions, then you will. And then here's the primary question that the text asks. Here's the question that we're going to ask is, where is God in our suffering? Now, I want you to look at this text with me again. Let's think about the story. Let's think about God's timing, especially in the life of Jairus here. First story. So the text begins by telling us that Jairus, this prominent man, this man of respect, is prostrate before Jesus. That's the sign of desperation. He's throwing away every sense of protocol, of decorum. And he's prostrate, saying, Lord, come, please, rabbi, teacher, come and do something. If you come right now, you can change things. And Jesus actually says yes. Now think about it. Put yourself right now in the shoes of Jairus. What is life like for you? Your daughter is on death's door. And Jesus, you hear, is something more than simply just a prophet, that he's some sort of magical healer. You at least hear rumors of this. You hear that this is a possibility. And so you have no other source and resource to turn to. There's no medicine. There's nothing else. And so you go to Jesus and say, Jesus, is it true? Is it possible? And Jesus says, yes, it is. And so for the first time since this sudden breaking in of suffering in your life for your daughter, for the first time you have hope. And so you begin that journey, and he's the synagogue ruler. Maybe he's there at the synagogue, and his home is just a few doors down. And so you begin, and there's this commotion of people, this massive, massive people moving along with Jesus, as always was the case wherever he went. And suddenly, Jesus stops. Now, I want you to put this perspective with me. Imagine with me that you're a doctor, okay? You're a doctor, and two people come to you in your office. First person comes to you and says, I think I'm having a heart attack. I think something's happening right now in me. Can you help? Then suddenly, as that person is saying that, the second person walks into your office, and they say, Doctor, I have this acute chronic illness. I've had it for 12 years, and can you work with me right now? Now, We would say that if that doctor works with a chronic patient first without addressing the acute issue in the room, we'd say that's malpractice. That's grounds for malpractice. What is Jesus, who calls himself the great physician, by the way, what does Jesus do? He stops for the chronic. See, that looks like malpractice on the surface, doesn't it? It really does. Which begs this question. Why is God's timing so different from ours? Why does it seem that he delays? Why does it seem that he waits too long to enter into our suffering, you see? That's the question. It may not be a polite question in polite company, but it's the question that you're asking, I suspect. It's a question that I've asked along the way. It's the timing. I mean, different cultures have different views of time, after all, right? Right? And, you know, I remember I was working with a group called CSI, not the CSI you're thinking of, but the Church of South India. And so for about 5 years, I worked with them doing some speaking leadership, especially with their young people. A young person was anyone who wasn't married. It was a youth in that culture. And so I was doing that, and I remember I was speaking one time, and like it was a 10 o'clock start time, and like there's no one there, you know, for as I'm beginning to speak. And as I think about it, it's a lot like our service here, come to think of it. By the way, we do have a call to worship, in case you're wondering. It's wonderful. You should come. Sorry. I just had to get that out. And so I'm there. There's no one in there. So finally, someone says, it's called IST, Indian Standard Time. And so, like, no one actually shows up at the time. It's supposed to, it's just different from your westernized cultures, what they were telling me like that. And the irony, I remember a couple years later, I was actually officiating a wedding for a couple that we got to know, and it was up in Long Island, and we're supposed to be picked up. We didn't have a car. The wedding time's approaching, and I'm the officiant, and, like, there's no car, so finally we call a taxi. There's traffic. We showed up for this wedding 30 minutes late. Like, everyone, there's 600 people in there. They're all waiting for the one white guy to show up to start this wedding. So talk about irony being defined there. But we all, it doesn't matter what culture you come from. We have different views of time. But no culture, here's the point, no culture would have looked at this and said, good timing, Jesus. There's something so radically wrong on the surface here. Yes. Listen, truth be told, I feel very fortunate that I have not experienced a lot of suffering in my life. A lot of tragedy, the way that Jerry Sitzer has, the way that some of you have. I haven't had that level of pain and suffering. But I remember when we first got married, some of you know the story, there was an experience for me in particular around infertility that was very painful for 3 years. Now, it wasn't permanent infertility. We had three biological children, so it was only temporary for 3 years. But I remember during that 3 years, it was extremely painful for me because when I went to the doctor essentially said, you're the problem, number one, and number two, there's not a whole lot we can do. And so when I read this text, I thought, get a little taste of that at least. There's not a lot. By the way, if you're a doctor, we know you're better than this, all right? You're different from the doctors in here. It's been 2,000 years. But still, like for me to go to the doctor and hear that, I remember thinking, God, where are you in my pain right now? Where are you? Like, it's been, and so month would go by, month after month. How long, O Lord? How long, O Lord, must we wait? Right? And so we look at God's timing, and is there ever a good time for suffering? Does it seem that God is always late? It does sometimes, at least I think, feel that way. I want you to hear a word. We've used it before. If you're here and you're brand new to City Church, you're saying, I'm thinking about sticking around. I want you to know this is the culture that you're dropping into if that's the case. Kairos. The word kairos isn't chronological time. That's chronos. But kairos means an event in time, something that's happening, something that's getting our attention. The smelling salts of life, you say. Something has happened in your life, chronic or sudden. There's something that's gathering your attention. And what's happening there is as you stand on the edge of that, on the edge of your pain, on the edge of your depression, on the edge of your anxiety, on the edge of your fear, on the edge of your physically diseased body, your marriage that's going south and sideways, what you do there is that you say, is God speaking? And this is what we train here at City Church, is ask the question, is God speaking into my pain right now? But at the same time, it can feel like God is still distant. Listen to what George MacDonald said. Why does God delay, he asks. He's a writer, a Christian writer. He said this. He may delay because it would not be safe to give us at once what we ask. We are not ready for it. To give ear we could truly receive would be to destroy the very heart and hope of prayer, to cease to be our Father. The delay itself may work to bring us near to our help, to increase the desire, perfect the prayer, and ripen the receptive condition. Listen to this. God is limited by regard for our best. You hear what he's saying? The very character of God is to give us his best. And that's the rub. We look at our suffering and we say, how could this be your best? How could this be your best? Over years, I've sat with people in our office, Mike has as well, and who said, I would not wish what's happened to me upon my worst enemy. But I'm so grateful for the smelling salts. I'm so grateful for how my life has been changed. I don't want to ever go back to where I was before I experienced the trauma, before I experienced the suffering, because it changed my view of God. It made God real for me. Just this past week, I had people in my office saying that exact same thing. Like, it's so painful what we've been through, but I'm so grateful for what I know about God, and it's changed my faith, it's changed my relationship. You know how many people have said that to me? If you're not experiencing that pain, that suffering, you would look at that rationally and say, that's bizarre. How could that be? Why would you say that? You're almost sound like you're welcoming the pain. They're not saying that, but they are saying, man, if I had a choice, no pain at all, or to experience God in a more abundant way because of the pain, I'm going to choose the latter. And only someone who's been through pain and come out on the other side with a different view of God could ever say that. You say, St. John of the Cross was a mystic centuries and centuries ago, and he wrote a work called The Dark Night of the Soul. It's now a catchphrase. Sometimes you'll hear people say that, the dark night of the soul. And what are they referring to? They're actually referring to his work. And he says, just like MacDonald, that it's in the place of the presence of your absence, as Pierce Pettis, the folk singer, sings, it tortures me. And St. John of the Cross was saying, I don't feel your presence right now. But the lack of your presence, it doesn't drive me away. It draws me to you with a hunger and a thirst, as we were using the psalm earlier. Why so downcast, O my soul? Put your hope in him. The hope of salvation. This is what St. John of the Cross was saying. And so I want to say this to you at the end of the first point. Suffering is a fork in the road. Suffering is always a choice, how you will deal with it. As we'll see more here in a second. But it's a fork in the road that says, will you be drawn or will you be driven away? And so the question here is, at the fork in the road for you right now, what do you sense God is saying? Where are you at? Where do you find yourself on the pathway? But here's the good news. The dark night of the soul doesn't last forever, because the second thing is that his touch in the midst of our suffering. Look here again at the text here, because what we're going to do is we're going to drop down into these stories in a little bit more detail now. And I want to specifically now look at her story, the story within the story of Jairus on the other side here. Look at verses 25 through 27, and let's see what she wants. And there was a woman who had had a discharge of blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had. It was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. Now, here's what's happening. This woman, again, we're not completely sure, but based on the language, a lot of commentators think it had something to do with menstruation. There's something that was not happening, because in that culture, when a woman was going through her menstruation on the monthly cycle there, for a week she couldn't go to the temple. That was part of the religious regulations, as it were. But this woman could never go to the temple, and because she could never go to the temple, she could never have a relationship with her community. This is the social ostracization that we're talking about. And this woman has spent everything that she has, all of her money, all of her energy for 12 years on these physicians, and nothing has happened. And just like the fact that she's not named in the story, she's a nobody. She's at the end of her rope, you know? And so she comes to Jesus, which is, first of all, remarkable enough. More on that here in just a second. But she hears that Jesus might be able to heal. And so she comes up close to Jesus, because back then there was a belief in that culture that a holy man had power emanating from him. And all you had to do was touch the cloak, touch something belonging to that person. It's sort of like talismans. You know what a talisman is? Or maybe if you've ever been to Europe and you've been to the great medieval cathedrals, the churches, the Catholic churches from centuries and centuries ago, you'll hear about the relics of the saints. And the belief was, even, you know, a few hundred years ago, that if you could just touch the relic of a saint, If you could just touch something belonging, the Shroud of Turin, things like that, right? If you could just do that, you could be healed of a disease. You could experience a cure. So what does this woman want? This woman almost has a quasi-superstitious faith, as it were. She believes that Jesus can be her talisman around her neck. Jesus can be her relic. And she's looking for a cure. And I want to say this to some of you today, okay? Some of you are saying, man, that's sort of like me coming in today. I don't have a lot, and I'm not even sure what I'm looking for here. But I want you to hear this. This is so important. If you're coming in this morning and you're saying, my faith feels so weak, I want you to hear, that's enough. It's enough. What is the point that I think Mark is telling us about this woman? What matters is not the strength of your faith this morning. It's the object of your faith. See, this woman treats Jesus like a talisman, but it's enough. See, Jairus had good theology. I mean, Jairus is one who worked in the synagogue. He was reading the scriptures all the time. He attended Theology 101 here at City Church this fall. Like, he's that kind of guy that would do that. Like, he knows his theology. He's on track for seminary-level education. He's been reading all the good books on good theology. And this woman, she hasn't darkened the door of a church in years, after all, right? And she has this almost syncretistic faith, like these belief systems about magic and things like that. And Jesus says, it's enough. Now, here's why it's enough. It's enough because even though it's quasi-superstitious, she still believes that Jesus can heal her. And her faith ultimately, and this is why Jesus heals her and says, it is your faith that has healed you. This is that when she touched his cloak, she believed that Jesus, the person, could heal her. At the same time, though, she's still just looking for a cure, and that's it. She wants to touch him anonymously and move on. But I want you to see next, how does Jesus respond? Look at verses 30 through 34 again. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, who touched my garments? And his disciples said to him, you see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, who touched me? We're on the busiest corner in New York, right, or Tokyo. And you're saying, who was it that touched me? You got to be kidding me, Jesus. And he looked about him to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. This woman, along with this man, they need a cure. But Jesus says you need more. You need a relationship. See, why does Jesus delay in our lives? Why did he delay? For the sake of a relationship with us. Because in our suffering and in our pain, there's something that we need to see beyond simply the cure, but what it means to be related rightly to him. And so this woman gets it. This woman who's called out of the anonymous crowd, as it were, who's called out to have a relationship with him. This is the Jesus of compassion. This is the Jesus who says, I don't want to just give you religion, because as we define religion here at City Church, if you're brand new, you won't know this, but if you've been here for any length of time, here's what we say. Religion is saying, I'm going to give God something, and he's going to give me something. It's a contractual relationship. But the grace of the gospel is, no, there's nothing that you could ever give him that would be enough to warrant a relationship, to warrant a repair of brokenness that sin and death have caused. And so he gives us grace. To this woman whose faith is quasi-superstitious, grace. To this man who has experienced nothing but prominence in his life and reputation, but now desperate, grace. You see, grace. It's the flavor of who Jesus is. It's the difference between our faith, Christianity, and religion. Right there in a nutshell. And so what's fascinating here in the text is the word here where he says, your faith has healed you. It's the same word that can also be translated salvation. It's a double entendre. He's saying, your faith has saved you. In other words, what you're placing you, the object of your faith, placing your hope and trust not in a solution. You've been looking for the doctors. You've been spending all of your money. I mean, how many of us in here, you know, whether it's physical suffering or something else, have looked at anything and everything, medicine, right? And that's wonderful. That's good. But in the whole equation of looking for help in our lives, for our marriages, they're going south and sideways, for the depression, for our loneliness and our singleness, for all these different things, and we've gone after all these different self-help books and all these other ways to trying to find help and solace in our lives. What I hear in this text is we begin, though, with him. He's saying, grace as well. Even if you've gone after other things, he says, come on to me, all you who are weary, all you who are broken. You've been after all these other things that haven't worked for you. And so come home. I'm enough. And this is the beauty of the grace of Jesus Christ, his touch, in the midst of our suffering, in a way that brings us out. One of the things that I see Jesus doing here is he says, you can't hide in your suffering. See, suffering can numb us. One of the things that suffering can do is that fork in the road is that rather than becoming a vibrant people, instead we become stoic people. We become numb people who don't feel anymore. And when you can't feel it for yourself and you can't feel for other people. It's called empathy. Brené Brown, some of you will know that name. She wrote a book called The Power of Vulnerability. And in that book, she talks at length about what is intimacy? What is vulnerability? She says the key to intimacy is vulnerability, actually. The key is being vulnerable. And so think about this text, this woman who's a complete nobody, socially on the outside, she has to be exposed. See, that's what suffering does. Suffering exposes us, and it says, will you be vulnerable? Will you come before your community? Some of you need to reveal your brokenness to this community. Let me just meddle in your life right now. Some of you have been holding on to it silently, privately, because you feel shame. And let me tell you how shame works. Shame works, its power is darkness. We call it name the shame. It's taking away the power of shame by giving it a name and allowing others to know its name in your life. If you are suffering this morning, the privilege opportunity you have is not to suffer alone, but to suffer in community with people who know your shame, people who have been down that road. The only way that you can know that you're not alone is to tell other people about your shame. The only way is to tell other people about your suffering. It's one of the things that we love is to pray confidentially for people every Tuesday. Now, we even say, please let us know, how can we be in your lives right now? How can we be part of your story? Dan Allen has a book called To Be Told, and he talks about like allowing God to tell your story. It's not the story that you have chosen for your life, but it's the story that you've been given. And so authoring, as it were, partnering with God to say, God, tell the story. Tell the story of my brokenness. Tell the story for your glory, right? And so let me challenge you this morning. Like, are you suffering alone? Or can you be vulnerable? Can you invite other people into the broken places in your life? That's what I hear. Jerry Sitzer puts it this way in that book I mentioned, Grace Disguised. He says, the decision to face the darkness, even if it led to overwhelming pain, it showed me that the experience of loss itself does not have to be the defining moment of our lives. Instead, the defining moment can be our response to the loss. It is not what happens to us that matters as much as what happens in us. It is our response. And so the question is, what do we do with that? The last thing I want you to see about the touch here. You see, at this point, we've said that Jesus is a healer. We know that. He's healed miraculously, but that doesn't make him Lord of the cosmos. You see, there's a deeper touch that's happening here that's so critical for us to see. When Jesus is touched by this woman, there's a transfer of power. There's also a transfer of uncleanliness. We see that here, that to be made ritually unclean. Jesus is made ritually unclean by her touch, but she's made clean because she's been forgiven. You see how that works? So she's been restored, but Jesus has been made dirty, as it were. But there's even a deeper picture here, and that's the transfer of power. If you were to look at all the different stories of Jesus, when he's doing exorcisms, when he's casting out demons, when he's bringing the power of nature to its knees with a storm on the sea, saying, be quiet, just like that. Nowhere in all of this text will you ever see it says that Jesus became weak. Jesus lost power. But in this text, uniquely, it says that he did. Why? And here's the reason why I think why. Because he's dealing with death itself. This woman has had a living death for 12 years. She's been in a living hell. That's her life. The daughter of Jairus has literally, physically died at that moment. She's experiencing now physical death. In that culture, no one believed in a resurrection in this life. They believed in a resurrection at the end of time in general, but no one believed that there could ever be a resurrection, which is why those professional mourners that had been hired, they're wailing, that was a thing back then. That's why they're mocking him, laughing at him. We know how to take a pulse, Jesus. She's dead. Are you kidding me here? There's been a transfer of power here, which leads us to the most important thing I could tell you this morning. In your suffering, there's a power over death itself that you can lean into because Jesus has defeated death itself. One of the most profound things is to look at that passage at the very end there. Because at the very end of the story, this is that Jesus comes in to the room where they've been laughing at him saying, oh, she's dead, all right. Like, well, there's nothing you can do here. That's what the messenger says. What does Jesus do? Jesus comes up to this little girl, and in the Aramaic, his original language, is Talitha Kumi. Talitha means little girl or daughter, sweetheart. And what does he do? He says, sweetheart, and he takes her by the hand. He says, Kumi. He says, it's time to get up. That's the picture here. This is of Jesus who approaches death. He approaches death and he says, sweetheart, it's time to get up. To me, that's a profound picture of the power that Jesus has over death, but make no mistake about it, it cost him his life. His power went out from him. In the woman, we see the power leave, and in the raising of this little girl to new life, at least temporarily, we see the power of God over death itself. Jesus is more than a healer. He's more than a teacher. He's more than a prophet. The proclamation of Mark here is that he's Lord of the cosmos. And we see a picture of that, just a taste of it, and it's temporary. But it's a taste of the power of Jesus. And so what do we do with this? Here's where we close. Because if you're here this morning and you've been listening, and I hope that you have been, the only question that remains is how do we have hope? Whether it's in the past, whether it's current suffering, it's what's going to happen. Because all of us are going to watch people die in our lives. All of us, as our bodies get older, are going to watch our bodies begin to break down more and more and more. All of us are going to see relationships that we had placed our trust and hopes in break down and shatter in our families, friendships. We're going to lose those careers. Suffering is tremendous. We must be realists. And so the question this morning is, how do we have hope? And this is not a step-by-step thing here where we're closing. But I want you to see the model. If you're seeing now the arc of suffering, now see the arc of hope in this passage. Here's the first thing that we need. Number one, you have to come to him desperate. There's no other way to approach him in your suffering than come with desperation. Put your decorum aside. Come praying in a blasted way. Come saying, Jesus, I have no one but you. Are you going to show up or not? Learn to pray that way. Learn to pray with gravitas. Learn to pray, saying, asking for it, which leads to the second thing, which is asking for faith. So number one, you come like these people, coming with movement, saying, look, you've got to do something here, but you ask for faith. I want you to see something. The enemy of good movement is bitterness. If you're suffering this morning and you're saying to yourself, you know what, I've been suffering chronically for X number of years, it's never going to change, you've become a cynic. You've become bitter. And the only way they can keep you from hope is to become bitter. And so even if you're saying, I don't know if you're going to heal my body physically, but I know you have more for me than bitterness. You come to him with movement. The second thing is you ask for that faith. Look at verses 35 and 36 with me again. This is so critical. I think we can easily miss this. While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house someone who said, your daughter's dead. Why trouble the teacher any further? But this is the key. But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, do not fear, only believe. What does that mean? What was Jesus asking of him? Jesus, I think, must have squared him with the shoulders. And he said, shift your vision from your circumstances to me. Suffering keeps your eyes on the pain and the suffering, especially if you're not used to it. And what Jesus says is, no, keep your gaze upon me. Trust right now, despite what your circumstances are telling you, trust that I'm enough. Discipleship, what does it mean to be a disciple? It means embodied action. It means not to be paralyzed with bitterness and other things, but to say, Lord, I don't have anything going right now. My faith is waning. Help my unbelief. There's a passage elsewhere where it says the disciples said to Jesus, give us the gift of faith, and he praised him for it. And so this morning, if you lack faith right now, okay, ask for faith. Don't think that you can somehow conjure faith up on your own. You can't. But ask him, so Lord, give me more faith. Faith in what? Leads to the last thing here, third thing here, is we embrace the Lord of the resurrection here. You know, he's more than a prophet here. I remember 2 weeks ago, I was at a conference on grief and suffering. And so I've been planning to preach this for about 12 months because I plan out 12 months in advance. We're at the end of the first year here. And so I've been planning it, but 2 weeks ago I was at a conference on grief and suffering where I was with 18 other pastors from around the country from about 6 or 7 different denominations. And as you can imagine, for 6 or 7 different denominations, we had different beliefs about different aspects of theology. But there's this one particular pastor, there are about 3 or 4 pastors representing their particular denomination. What they believed was that the resurrection of Jesus Christ, it wasn't a physical resurrection, but it was metaphorical. And I remember they said this almost with pride. They said, well, we don't believe that the resurrection of Jesus is really something that happened in history. We think that when we die, what happens is that our spirits are resurrected in the memories of our loved ones. That who we are, it echoes into eternity. And I thought to myself when I heard that, I said, are you kidding me? Even our great-grandchildren won't even remember who we are. Our memories last maybe a few years, and then that's it? Where's the hope in that? When someone's on their deathbed and you tell them that, where's the hope in that? The only hope there is to embrace the one who died in history and was raised in history, who physically was consumed by death and physically defeated death itself, which leads to the very last thing here, and that is you must embrace your future. Because the last thing I need to tell you, to be honest with you, is this. Most of you, if you pray for a miracle in your life physically because of chronic illness, or maybe it's more sudden, is it your suffering, most of you will not receive that miracle. I don't know if that surprises you to hear that from me, but you need to know that. I mean, most of us have prayed. I mean, many of you have prayed. I know your stories. And if you're true like the other statistics, the fact is a lot of people in here won't receive what you think that you need. But that's the whole point. You need to embrace your future. Because the future is, because of the past, the cross, because of the resurrection that happened in history, your future history has already been taken care of. That's your hope. You need something more than the cure. If you just receive the cure, what would happen if that's all that you needed? Listen to what David Garland is. This is where we close. He said this: the little girl is spared death for now, but has not been given a total reprieve. The woman has been healed for now, but she will face new ailments as she grows older. Faith, however, is able to hold on in the face of death, knowing that God has conquered death in the resurrection of Christ. The good news for you this morning is, even if he doesn't heal your body physically, this side of heaven, even if he doesn't heal your marriage, this side of heaven, even if he doesn't heal your loneliness, your depression, this side of heaven, he's given you the greater gift, and that is the ability to hope and to trust that the one, as the psalmist says, yea, that you slay me, I will place my trust in you, for you have my future. If our faith means anything at all, it means that. It means that the resurrection happened and the resurrection will happen for you and for me. So may he give us the faith to endure. May he give us the faith to believe that he's touching us in the midst of our pain and suffering. May he give us the faith to embrace our future. Let's pray. Father, we know that these are heavy things because your timing seems so inopportune. So, Father, would you give us ears to hear and eyes to see? What is it that you're saying to us in the midst of our pain? What are you saying to us in the midst of our suffering? How is it that you're calling for us to receive more than simply a quick fix to our suffering, but to get you in the place of it? So, Jesus, you said that you're enough, that as long as we have you, we have your gospel, that we'll have what it takes to maintain presence of mind and heart in the midst of loneliness and depression, broken relationships, diseased bodies, great suffering. So Jesus, we need your promises to come true. Yea, though you tarry, though you delay. Yea, though it look like you slay us. May we trust that you are enough for us in the midst of the storms. Pray this in your name, Jesus.